Hi, I'm Sam Dingman, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, more and more people are eschewing traditional Thanksgiving gatherings for Friendsgiving.
And Flagstaff's role in America's obsession with Mars.
But first, in a recent piece for The Atlantic, Dr. Jason Leibowitz, a physician and professor at Columbia University, sounds the alarm about what he sees as a troubling trend. Popular culture, he writes, quote, has latched on to the concept of inflammation and made it a catch-all term for something amiss in the body, a bête noire for wellness gurus, health influencers, and the Make America Healthy Again movement. Leibowitz goes on to write about his experience treating patients who come in with misguided perceptions about inflammation, why they have it, and how to treat it. This current obsession with inflammation may seem new, but at the University of Arizona's Andrew Weil Medical Center for Integrative Medicine, it's an issue they've been studying for a long time. The Weil Center, in fact, has a lot to do with the general public's awareness of inflammation in the first place. Weil's doctors advocate specific forms of diet and lifestyle to counter the negative impacts of inflammation, and their work is sometimes used as a scientific basis for the less reliable information that internet wellness culture spins into social media fodder. Dr. Stephen Dahmer is a physician at Weil, and he says it's important to understand what inflammation actually is. There's good inflammation. It's how the body reacts, for example, if you accidentally slice your finger while you're cutting an apple. But there's also bad inflammation, where the body turns on itself and inflames internal organs and joints, leading to autoimmune diseases like IBS and rheumatoid arthritis. As Dr. Dahmer recently told me, those conditions can be debilitating, and he understands the hunger for answers about how to treat them.
Well, I think we always are looking for, you know, some form to better our health. And I think, you know, it's long been held in many cultures that, you know, inflammation is a root cause of many diseases that we face. And we've been seeing also a lot of literature and science that support the importance of microbiome, an altered microbiome, and the inflammation that can ensue from that and how that might impact the body's overall health and trigger disease. So I think it's a, like many things, it's a perfect storm of a culprit to point to that makes intuitive sense. And science even has, you know, supported it in ways to showcase how there might be a way that this can contribute to disease.
And am I right to make a possible association there between, you know, just since you brought up the microbiome, we have also in recent years, and particularly in the last couple of years, with the rise to prominence of figures in the so-called MAHA movement, we've seen an increase in scrutiny on things like artificial dyes in foods, these sorts of things. Is the idea that because of the increased scrutiny of things like that, that is leading some folks to wonder whether there's a correlation between those things and an increase in inflammation in the body?
Yeah, I think that I think this concern, right, for inflammation being a driving force for, you know, many illnesses and symptoms and disease processes long predated that. But I think that, you know, has it been a perfect storm where that's really added to, you know, the discussion of inflammation, where it rises to the point of articles and things that become mainstream?
So a lot of the work that you and others do at Weil is around lifestyle, and in particular, diet.
Absolutely. You know, since the time of Hippocrates, where it was more anecdotal and would observe these clear connections between, you know, right nutrition and better health and wrong nutrition and worse health, we've seen a whole slew of science that supports the connection between nutrition and our overall health, specifically chronic disease. And if we want to hone in on the area of inflammation, you know, one, I would just say that it's difficult. It's difficult for our gold standard, a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial, to do that with a dietary intervention, right? This is not a drug, single drug intervention. So becomes much harder to do that work. And oftentimes the support or even the funding for it is not as prominent. Yet the studies exist. one that was a randomized controlled single blinded crossover study in rheumatoid arthritis, found positive effects of anti-inflammatory diet. That's where we're really looking at omega-3 fatty acids, fiber, probiotics, and how that impacted in a positive way disease activity scores in rheumatoid arthritis patients. It's not binary. It's not that you can utilize a DMARD or the latest of pharmaceutical interventions for an autoimmune disease, or you can approach a dietary and lifestyle modification for your disease. The two go best hand in hand. And it's truly our belief that that combination of integrative medicine, right, the lifestyle intervention with the latest in pharmaceutical therapies is what will afford best outcomes for our patients.
And I know that you guys also advocate for things like yoga, meditation, Tai Chi in concert with dietary adjustments. There are folks who follow wellness influencers online who are concerned that it is, in fact, some of the medicines that have created these conditions of chronic inflammation that they feel like they're struggling with. What is your reaction to that, since a moment ago you were talking about the fact that it is through the combination of some of the things that you recommend at Weill and pharmaceutical interventions that these treatments can be really effective?
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful question. And I think that, you know, when you're a physician on the front lines for 20 years, as I've been, I came from clinic this morning, Sam, is, you know, health and personal health is very nuanced. And across the board, do I believe in an FDA process that approves these medications that have anti-inflammatory effects on those that suffer from autoimmune disease? Absolutely. I think that they have a tremendous role in helping patients with quality of life better manage their disease. Do they actually trigger inflammation? You can find different ways to unravel that, right? If you are on a strong, extremely strong anti-inflammatory like prednisone and you remove that prednisone, is there a rebound effect where inflammation might occur when you pull that drug away? I believe that there is. Does that mean that the drug actually caused inflammation? No, I wouldn't say that. But this is the challenge, right, in really meeting people where they're at and addressing their concerns specifically and head on, you know, as it relates to their body and their disease.
Are you concerned at all that there is somewhat of a culture of distrust amongst some in this wellness movement towards the medical establishment, which I imagine you would consider yourself to be a part of, and that because of that culture of distrust, people are going more towards influencers and folks of that nature and not getting good information? Whereas you're saying that there may in fact be some truth to some of the things that they're finding online, but a person in your position, if I'm hearing you correctly, is in the best position to help somebody truly identify what's happening.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, you're hitting the nail on the head, Sam, is the why behind the why. And that's something that we really try to explore within integrative medicine. I would absolutely agree we're seeing increasing distrust of the medical system. I feel it as a physician on the front lines. And why is that? Oftentimes, you know, in integrative medicine, we like to, rather than ask a patient what's the matter, what matters most? And their quality of life, their stress. It's that patient perspective I think sometimes we're missing in modern medicine. And rather than meeting a patient where they're at and establishing rapport, we throw the baby out with the bathwater. Mm-hmm. And anything but, you know, the pharmaceutical intervention is on the wrong side of right, which the patient is gonna take issue with and will walk away with increased distrust of the system. And I think sometimes we have to be frank of the limits of what we know, but phrase it in a way that can establish rapport that helps a patient to understand. We don't know all the nuances of inflammation, nor exactly why you got this disease, but these are our approaches to best improve your life.
Well, Dr. Stephen Dahmer is the director of the Andrew Weill Center for Integrative Medicine at the University of Arizona. Dr. Dahmer, thank you for this conversation.
Sam, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on, and we appreciate it.
As I mentioned earlier, rheumatoid arthritis is one of the chronic diseases caused by inflammation. It is a painful, life-altering condition, And recently, the FDA approved a new treatment for it that our next guest says has the potential to drastically improve patients' quality of life. It's called Setpoint Therapy, named for the company that created it, Setpoint Medical. It's a tiny pill-sized implant that's inserted into the body. Dr. John Tesser is a rheumatologist here in the Valley and a professor at the U of A's Medical School. He served as the national principal investigator during the trial period for Setpoint Therapy. He says the implant, works by stimulating the vagus nerve in the neck, which then sends signals into the spleen.
In the spleen, there are immunologically active cells that are able to produce inflammatory chemical messengers called cytokines. And these cytokines, if they're upregulated, will promote inflammation. And if they're downregulated, they will downregulate inflammation.
Okay.
And the device can set off an electrical signal to downregulate those splenic cells.
So it's a very small device, right? It's like the size of a pill, right?
Yes. And this device, as being an integrated one, has a battery in it. The device, of course, is in the neck, and it is sewn by putting it into a silicone pod around the left vagus nerve by a neurosurgeon or a very experienced ear, nose, and throat surgeon. The procedure takes maybe an hour.
Uh-huh.
It's an outpatient procedure, and the device is programmed to release a stimulation for 1 minute a day. 1 minute of an electrical pulse can cause a downregulation of the immune system.
This therapy was recently approved by the FDA, but prior to that approval, in the clinical trials, as I understand it, the results were remarkable, right, in terms of the difference that this treatment made in patients' day-to-day pain.
Pain and function, yes, absolutely. And only 25% of the patients by the end of 1 year had had any advanced therapy added to the device therapy, which is also remarkable.
A lot of the other ways of treating rheumatoid arthritis, which I realize this set point therapy that we're talking about doesn't replace, but in many cases, other treatments are fairly invasive and carry some other health risks with them, right?
Yeah, that's very true. So there are a number of historical inflection points to bring out about this therapy. One, it's the first device that's been approved to treat rheumatoid arthritis. It's very likely that Setpoint is going to start doing clinical trials in multiple sclerosis and inflammatory bowel disease.
Oh, wow.
And it's the first therapy that's not a drug therapy. So the therapies you were alluding to are all drug therapies. We have disease-modifying antirheumatic drugs, including methotrexate and leflunomide and sulfasalazine. These are pills. And then we have the biologic therapies, including things that people probably know about over the years, Enbrel, Remicade, Humira, and many others. And then there are the newer pills called JAK inhibitors. And all of these therapies are drug therapies which have potential adverse events, major adverse cardiovascular events like heart attack, strokes, blood clots in other areas of the body, serious infections like pneumonias that put people in the hospital, or cancer.
Yeah.
All of the drugs that we have certain concerns about their associations with these things. And one of the amazing advantages of this therapy is that I want to point out to people, most people do not get side effects on drugs.
Mm.
And during the course of the trial, patients who are not doing well enough could have advanced therapies added to the electrical stimulation device.
Oh, and interesting. So it can work in concert with those therapies.
Yes. And patients who are on those therapies could have this added to it.
For folks who have maybe heard of rheumatoid arthritis, but don't necessarily know what the day-to-day experience of living with it is, could you describe just how debilitating this condition can be?
Yes, and I'm glad you brought this up. What happens is the person's own immune system winds up recognizing different proteins and other small molecules within cells as being foreign. And it's kind of like your army now is turning on yourself, and there's a civil war that's being waged. The weaponry that's used is inflammation. The inflammation that's targeted to different organs, and specifically and most prominently in rheumatoid arthritis or the joint tissue, can lead to pain and swelling and stiffness, which can lead to dysfunction. Anyone who's sprained an ankle, that's inflammation, and they know what that's like. Imagine that in multiple joints in all your fingers and your toes and other major joints, and the inflammation over time can cause damage. That can lead to deformities and worsening of function. Fatigue is the second most reported symptom after pain. So living with this disease is basically hell, to be honest with you.
Yes. And so is that the reason that this implanted device therapy seems to hold potential for treating those other conditions like lupus, IBS, multiple sclerosis, because those two are caused by the effects of severe inflammation?
That's exactly right, Sam. So you can think of it like the inflammation is the weaponry. That's the source of all of the symptoms and the damage that happens in organs in these diseases. And if this type of therapy can downregulate the common source of the damage-causing and symptom-causing effects of a disease, then this has potential to help many of the autoimmune diseases and potentially other diseases that are not necessarily autoimmune, but the inflammation is the common denominator.
Well, Dr. Tesser, we've been talking about this treatment in almost like miraculous terms, in terms of the potential for the difference it seems to be able to make in patients' lives. I listened to an interview that you gave a while back on this subject, and you mentioned that initially when you heard about it, you were a little skeptical. Obviously, you've come around. I'm wondering what your skepticism was and whether you still have any reservations about it.
My skepticism was one that all rheumatologists and other people should have. Stimulating a nerve to control an immunologic disease, you should be skeptical until you delve into the basic science. And that explains it. And interestingly enough, obviously, I now understand it. And I saw the translation of this in the clinical trials, the phase two and now the phase three trials. And now I'm having to go out and help with others to educate my peers about this. They're all very excited. Because once you understand the science and the translation, it becomes very apparent that this is a really great thing.
Well, I have been speaking with Dr. John Tesser of Arizona Arthritis and Rheumatology Associates. He's also a clinical assistant professor at the University of Arizona Medical School in Phoenix. Dr. Tesser, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you very much. It's been very enjoyable.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, we all know the Thanksgiving classics, the turkey, the mashed potatoes, the green beans. But a local chef tells us why he likes to fixate on what goes alongside these holiday standards.
But first, the Trump administration wants developers to be able to get permits for hydropower projects on tribal lands, even if those tribes object. That would require changing a Biden-era rule, which did not issue those permits if the tribes didn't consent to the projects. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has been reporting on this and joins me now to talk more about it. Gabe, good morning.
Morning, Mark.
So what exactly does the Trump administration want to do here?
Basically, they want to undo that Biden-era rule that was established last year in 2024. We've seen here in Arizona that it's already been used to stop projects that tribes didn't agree to. And essentially, these are preliminary permits. What that means is essentially there isn't construction to be done, but it's the initial process to open up these projects down the line that would take potentially decades to develop and could last for up to a century, depending on what type of project they are.
So what were the rules before the Biden administration made it so that tribes could basically say, no, thanks, we don't want it?
Essentially, it was what the Trump administration is asking for now, which was that basically, there wasn't a rule that said that they couldn't send or submit these permits initially. So basically, they could give permits out, preliminary permits to developers, oftentimes more likely than not off-reservation developers here in the Valley, across Indian country as a whole. We're seeing that a lot of people are coming in to develop their resources on their lands and going through that process of getting permits from the feds and then going through the process to consult with tribes afterward. And what tribes are saying is they should have a say in the early phase of development with these permits, that they could say whether these are feasible or not. Oftentimes these projects fall through because of the fact that there isn't feasibility, essentially.
So would the tribes, assuming the Trump administration rule goes into effect, would the tribes have any say in projects that are happening on their lands?
Not initially, at least in this case, because of the fact that they would issue these permits. And then at the end, they could go through commenting phases, and that would be the dialogue essentially with the developer and the tribal leadership, depending on where these projects would be proposed, on what lands they're situated on, and what resources they're using. It could go later on, but it's drawn out essentially. So instead of kneecapping these projects that aren't feasible, aren't realistic, like Big Canyon Dam, which is one of the ones that is here in Arizona, they drag it out. And part of the Trump administration mentality is to essentially say, like, this is efficient. By giving these permits, we're helping expedite the process, when in actuality, from the tribe's perspective, they feel that this is actually creating more burdensome bureaucracy for that process to commence.
Well, so you mentioned the Big Canyon Dam, and you alluded to the fact that this – the Biden-era rule has been used a few times in Arizona. What are some of the projects that developers were maybe high on and the tribe said, no thanks?
Black Mesa is one of the big ones, which was a hydro pump storage project in a historic Navajo coal mining community, reeling from the impacts of those facilities being shut down as we kind of transition more toward renewable energy, away from fossil fuels. And so that was one project that was stopped because of opposition by Navajo and as well as Hopi leadership. But the Big Canyon Dam in particular was denied a preliminary permit by FERC, which is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and last April 2024. And this project was going to be developed by pump hydro storage to dam the Big Canyon, which is a few miles from Grand Canyon National Park. The Phoenix developer actually wanted to pump gallons of groundwater to fill a reservoir. And that would endanger the confluence of the Colorado River, which is considered sacred and culturally significant to Hopis and Navajos. And the Little Colorado River to Hopis is considered their place of emergence. They refer to it as Sipapa, which is the umbilical cord. And I spoke to Navajo Acting Assistant Attorney General Erica Perot, who penned the nation's response.
We opposed and they never pursued. That one was a bad idea to start with. I think that was someone that probably hadn't paid attention to the water source and any cultural awareness of the confluence.
And so as you could hear from Acting Assistant Attorney General Perot, you hear that some of these projects are just not well-researched and could endanger the water resources. And this is a problem across Indian country, but especially here in the Southwest with our dwindling water supply with mega drought and things of that sort.
Are there projects that tribes are interested in? Like, it would – I guess maybe the question is, would – did the Biden-era rule sort of stop all projects, or are there maybe some that, you know, tribal leaders and developers could work together on for something that the developers would be happy with and the tribes would be happy with?
It wasn't a full stop. And in my discussion with Perot, you know, she had disclosed that there are at least two projects that are in a feasibility stage now.
Hmm.
After the rule change under Biden, in their brief, they articulated that this rule isn't a hindrance to development on these lands. In fact, it's actually facilitated better dialogue, better consultation, and more streamlined process to consider the merits of these projects when they come in. I think tribes are open to business. It's just a matter of whether it impacts resources in a way that harms the environment, as we heard from conversation I had with Hopi leadership, including Hopi Council Member Darren Melvin.
not being able to consult or consent or input. I found that as a veiled reference to assert that kind of priority, what they want to pursue versus what we as those on the land would deem inappropriate for the resources and the ways that we try to protect it.
Well, Gabe, it kind of sounds like there's a question of tribal sovereignty at the root of all this. Is that a fair assessment?
For sure. I think that it's guided in the idea of consent, sovereignty, and kind of in this case, the current administration's reverting, as you've reported on the show, about the Solar for All program, this kind of deviating from the Biden era renewable energy initiative, solar, wind, to now fossil fuels and other industries that the Trump administration is looking to promote at this point. And kind of tribes are caught in the whims, so to speak, of the White House and what direction we're going in when it comes to energy development, as we've seen with the National Emergency Declaration on new energy initiatives and things of that sort.
Sure. All right. That is KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio. Gabe, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Earthlings have been interested in Mars and the potential for life on the red planet for more than a century. NASA's acting administrator said in September that a sample collected from a rover last year is, quote, the closest we have ever come to discovering life on Mars. Science writer David Baron explores the initial interest in whether there was life on Mars in his latest book, The Martians, the true story of an alien craze that captured turn-of-the-century America. He joins me to talk more about this. And David, what role does Arizona play in this story from the early 1900s?
Arizona is central to this tale. Percival Lowell, the astronomer from Boston who established the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, which is still there, was the main proponent of the idea that there was a civilization on Mars. He was not the only one, but he was the person who really took this idea and ran with it and convinced the public, including such notables as Alexander Graham Bell, that there really was a civilization on Mars, to the point that there was attempts to communicate with the Martians. It all started in Arizona.
And what was Lowell's evidence for this? Why did he think that there was life on Mars?
Well, you have to put yourself back into the late 19th century. All we knew about Mars was what could be seen through an Earth-bound telescope. We didn't have, of course, rovers up there looking at the actual surface. But through a telescope from Earth, even a large telescope, you have to contend with the Earth's atmosphere, which kind of blurs the image. It comes in and out of focus. But the telescopes were good enough that they could see patterns on the surface of Mars, dark areas and light areas that looked like oceans and continents. But some astronomers, including Percival Lowell, also saw this strange network of lines, so straight and narrow that they looked drawn with a ruler. And it was a great mystery what these things were. And Percival Lowell came up with a theory, which at the time was actually kind of an interesting one, that these lines were irrigation canals that the Martians were using to survive on a planet that was running out of water. And so that was the basis for his speculation about Mars, these strange lines that didn't seem to be explainable, he said, by any other theory.
And as you say, this gained a fair bit of traction. It sounds like it wasn't dismissed out of hand as being, you know, being crazy or something at the time. Like, people seemed to think this might actually be what was going on.
Well, again, there was this mystery. What were these lines on Mars? And they seemed to come and go with the seasons. And so Percival Lowell said, well, you're not actually seeing the water in the canals, because the canals would have to be enormous to be seen from Earth. But you were seeing vegetation, he said, growing on the banks of these canals that would green up in the spring and then fade in the fall. It was a consistent theory. And there were reasons to think that Mars might be inhabited. Mars was thought to be an older planet than Earth that had solidified first, that had become potentially habitable first. So if there was life there, perhaps it had become civilized and even was more advanced than we are. So it fit with ideas at the time. But over time, it went from an interesting theory to something that really was embraced, to the point where the Wall Street Journal, this is not some tabloid newspaper, the Wall Street Journal in 1907 said the biggest news of the year was proof of intelligent life on Mars.
Well, so I guess at what point did it become clear that these lines were not, in fact, irrigation canals on Mars?
Well, so this was widely debated for a good decade and a half in the 1890s and through the first decade of the 20th century. There were astronomers who all along were saying they didn't believe these lines were really there, or at least they weren't as straight and clean as Lowell depicted them. That, you know, we all know that our eyes are prone to optical illusions. But that too was just a theory, and the question was who was right. Well, Lowell really was taken down finally in 1909, in a year when Mars came especially close to Earth, and so astronomers were keeping a close eye on it because it was a good opportunity to see the surface. And it was an astronomer in France who actually had previously believed in the canals. He had drawn maps of the canals, who on one especially clear night in 1909, looking through the largest telescope in Europe, he looked where the lines should have been, where he had himself drawn them, and they weren't there. It was just a natural landscape of, you know, just meandering shapes and speckling and so forth. But the eye, looking at something that isn't clear, will tend to connect up dots and see lines that aren't there. And that was the beginning of Lowell's downfall.
What do you think this episode with Lowell and, you know, predicting that, you know, trying to prove that there was life on Mars, what does that say about this planet's interest in Mars and the possibility of life there?
Oh, a heck of a lot. So, I mean, I got into this, I decided to write this book because I grew up in the 1960s when I was surrounded by Martians when I was a kid. There was Marvin the Martian in the Looney Tunes cartoons. There was a TV sitcom called My Favorite Martian. There were Martians in comic books and Martians in sci-fi novels. And I wanted to get to the bottom of what is it about Mars that has captured our imagination, and it all goes back to Percival Lowell. It all goes back to Flagstaff in 1894 when he founded the observatory. And on the one hand, it can be seen as a cautionary tale, and it is, about how easy it is for us to fool ourselves into believing things that aren't true. That's true for the individual, like Percival Lowell. It kind of was true for all of America, because people really wanted to believe that there was a better society on the planet next door. So it's a cautionary tale, but it's also actually an inspirational one, because Lowell inspired a whole new generation of people to imagine life in outer space. And it was the excitement about Mars that he started that launched science fiction as we know it in the 20th century and actually got us into outer space.
It's so interesting that the conventional wisdom at the time was that the Martian society was so far ahead of ours. Because like it just seems like that kind of goes against the conventional wisdom of, like, we currently, at whatever era you're in, are at the pinnacle of civilization and technology and innovation, that it seems almost like a sense of humility back then that we don't seem to have now, that there could be this society that's so much more advanced than ours.
Oh, that figured in very much to why the public wanted to believe this. You know, we think of the late 1800s as the Gilded Age, this glorious time. It was not a glorious time to live. You know, there was, of course, the great divide between the rich and so many more who were poor. There was violent labor unrest. There was anarchy in Europe. Heads of state were being assassinated. That included William McKinley, who was assassinated in 1901. There was a sense that things were falling apart on Earth. And in fact, people said quite directly, we hope that there is a civilization more advanced than we are, that is more moral than we are, that has learned to live in peace. And those were the Martians, because Mars was thought to be an older planet than Earth. The Martians were in advance of us. And we hoped, the humans here hoped, that the Martians would be our saviors.
So in theory, then, we would learn from them. They would show us the way to make our society more evolved and just generally better?
There's a wonderful, wonderful newspaper article that ran in many papers across the country in 1909, when again there was talk of communicating with Mars. And this newspaper article was headlined, "Questions Mars Might Answer." And you would think it would be things like, how do you build a canal? Or how do you perfect the airplane? Because, you know, the Wright brothers had just started at that time. No, the list of questions, they were the most existential questions. What is the purpose of life? Wow. How can we prevent human suffering? What is the right way to live? The Martians had become almost stand-ins for God. That's why people wanted so much to believe in the Martians. And when Percival Lowell said there was this advanced society there, the public was ready to believe.
Wow, that's so fascinating. All right, David, thanks so much. It was really nice to talk to you.
It was my pleasure, Mark. Thanks for your time.
David Barron is a science writer. His newest book is called The Martians, The True Story of an Alien Craze That Captured Turn-of-the-Century America. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. With Thanksgiving just around the corner, next week is shaping up to be one of the most intense travel periods of the year. But not everyone travels for Thanksgiving. If you've ever worked a job where you don't get the holiday off or lived far away from your family, you might be familiar with the concept of Friendsgiving. It's an alternative to the traditional big biological family gathering, and it's especially common amongst millennial and Gen Z folks, and it's more popular than ever. Here to tell us more about it is the show's resident pop culture expert, Amanda Kerberg. Amanda, good morning.
Good morning.
So let's clear up a misconception first.
Yes.
A lot of people associate Friendsgiving with the TV show Friends.
They
Not
do.
Accurate, right?
No, it doesn't technically come from the Friends era. In fact, Merriam-Webster wasn't even tracking the term until around 2007 when it starts popping up on Usenet, like classic message boards, Twitter. But we really associate, I think, it with Friends because Friends had such beautiful and hilarious and classic Friends Thanksgiving episodes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Friends, of course, a huge millennial touch point culturally.
Yes. Yeah.
Let's talk about why Friendsgiving is so associated with millennial and Gen Z folks.
I think those are the two generations that started to grow up considered millennials were called digital natives, and then Gen Z really were. but we're talking about two generations who grew up so saturated in media, and then particularly digital media, and so our sense of our relationships to people began to move away from the family as a core unit to our friends, our colleagues, all of these people that algorithmically were more and more closely tied to, based on shared values, shared interests, shared activities, things that are not that kind of traditional, these are my classic family relationships.
Interesting. Well, so, I mean, let's talk about what we mean when we say Friendsgiving, because,
yes.
You know, it often gets referred to as like an alternative to Thanksgiving. But in terms of what's actually happening, it's not so different, right?
It's really not. And I think for a lot of people, it's an add-on, too. It's not even necessarily a replacement. It's still about getting together with people you care about. It's about being grateful, sharing a meal, sharing memories, and having that kind of warm, fuzzy feeling with a community, even if it's a community that you've built and not one that you just sort of entered the world with.
But this is really interesting what you're saying about the digital layer to all this,
yeah,
and the sense of connection that feels different generationally amongst younger folks, which, you know, we think of Thanksgiving sometimes as like this very warm thing, but for a lot of people, they associate Thanksgiving with like awkward conversations,
yes,
and nervousness about family. Does that play into millennial and Gen Z folks pull towards these sorts of gatherings?
I think absolutely, yes. We're in an era now of extreme media fragmentation. So like so much of our lives are lived and experienced through these screens that are showing us very different perspectives on the world. So we don't necessarily have as much in common with our family when we sit down and we haven't seen them in a while. And that's how it turns into this thing that makes people so uncomfortable, because it feels like sitting around a table with people who really might not share your values, might not care about the issues you care about. And it can be, particularly last year, that was all we were talking about, right, was how tense the idea of sitting at the Thanksgiving table was, given the kind of uncertainty and stress that's surrounding us in the world right now. So being able to sit down with people that you're just like, okay, yeah, we're all on the same page. Hey, we all happen to watch that show. We know the same memes. We're
right.
Just like, it can just be maybe a way to experience that joy of the holiday that I feel like in some ways we've moved away from. Yeah.
One of the things I think a lot of people associate with a more traditional biological family Thanksgiving also is tradition, which can sometimes feel very welcome and can sometimes feel a little heavy on the shoulders.
Yes, exactly.
But at a Friendsgiving celebration, the rules are a little bit looser in general, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. You can do it like with a theme. You can do it with a potluck. It can be just totally something that everybody in the friend group wants to do. I think like one of the things that's especially great about doing a potluck is like if you think about your kind of classic traditional Thanksgiving menu that you grew up with, maybe there's one dish on that that's really, really good. And if everybody brings that one dish instead of, you know, the tyrannical need to do the full list every year, then you are getting a really good Thanksgiving. Yeah. I mean, you can also mix up styles of food. You know, maybe put a little more spice on it than some of your Midwestern relatives would.
I just have to say, speaking as the person at my family's Thanksgiving who is often tasked with making the least complicated thing.
No, that's me too.
I can appreciate the idea of going to a meal where it's like we don't have to apologize for any of these dishes.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Like you did not destroy grandma's cream corn. You made box stuffing and it was amazing.
Let me zoom out a little bit here, Amanda. I mean, it's tempting to make an association here with the discourse around, you know, we hear that millennials have ruined staying in hotels. We've heard that millennials have ruined all these things about
mayonnaise, chilies.
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Do you see an element of that here in the discourse around Friendsgiving?
That's, you know, I think there's certainly a way to look at it like that. Yeah, that there is, because there's a breaking with tradition. There is a generation that's saying, like, I not only might not be back this year for Thanksgiving, I might not be back next year either. I mean, that takes a lot of strength, I think, too. And that can be a very hard shift, but I think that it's okay. I think that it's okay to say, hey, maybe some things are changing, but we're still leading with love here. We're getting together with people we care about. We're celebrating. We're sharing this experience. And maybe it doesn't look like it has looked for decades, but it's still beautiful.
Yes. Well, Amanda Kerberg is a PhD student at ASU and, again, our resident expert on all things culture. Amanda, thank you.
Thank you.
With Thanksgiving right around the corner, you might be getting ready to stock your kitchen with all the ingredients to make the turkey, stuffing, mashed potatoes, and cranberry sauce, you know, the typical stuff. And if you are, our next guest has some tips for you. Chef Doug Robson is the chef and founder of Gallo Blanco Cafe, Otro Cafe, and Tesota. And our co-host Lauren Gilger got him on the line to talk about all things Thanksgiving cooking.
I like to do a lot of baking around the holidays, so every year, I take on the baking aspect of it, as well as making the turkey and mashed potatoes. I mean, I pretty much do all of it. I enjoy the whole ensemble of it. But what I get fixated on is usually, you know, what goes with the turkey that is not the mashed potatoes and the green beans, but the breads and the pastries.
Like rolls, things like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do roll. So I've been doing variations, you know, from like an Irish soda bread to your traditional dinner rolls. This year, I'm going to attempt something a little bit different that I've been working on. I've been laminating my own dough. So I'm basically going to do some croissant rolls, but more in the style of not a croissant, but you roll them like you would a cinnamon roll, and then you bake them in a cast iron skillet. So you have the flakiness and the buttery aspects of you know, a croissant.
I love that. Because if you think about bread and Thanksgiving, yes, it's all about the gravy and the use of the bread in the meal, right?
Oh, you got to have a vehicle, right, for the gravy to get in your mouth, and you're not going to use a spoon. We're much more civilized, so we'll just, like, dunk it in bread and shove it in our mouths, you know.
So you come from an interesting kind of culinary background. Your mother is French Vietnamese. You grew up in Mexico. You do sort of international food at Tisota, but you do Mexican food at some of your other restaurants. You're kind of known for that. But I want to talk a little bit about how those culinary influences tend to manifest themselves in this very Americana meal on Thanksgiving. Like, do you tend to do a traditional Thanksgiving at home?
You know, it's just been recently that, you know, we've kind of made it a tradition to do turkey on Thanksgiving. Years before, we've done chayo, spring rolls, and pho. Like, mm-hmm. we've made a turkey pho one year. It was really good. It was really good. But, you know, as all the kids are grown up and, you know, in the last couple of years, we've settled to do a traditional Thanksgiving meal.
Mm-hmm.
But I do a couple things, you know, like with my turkey stuffing.
Yeah.
We usually use, you know, a variety of bread and croutons. And my stuffing mix is usually celery, onions, you know, lots of garlic, all the traditional stuff, the fresh herbs like the thyme, mm-hmm. a little bit of sage, fresh parsley. But what I like to do is I actually use a little bit of soy sauce when I'm seasoning my stuffing.
Mm.
And I chop up water chestnuts and I add water chestnuts to my stuffing. So when you eat this, in addition with the celery, when you eat it, you have this little crunch of texture of the water chestnuts. It's actually, you know, pretty darn tasty. But you just reminded me I need to get my list going for Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
So we don't forget these ingredients.
What made you want to go back to a traditional Thanksgiving meal after doing it differently in the past? That's interesting. Like, after the kids are gone, you're like, no, we're going to do it this way now.
Well, you know, the kids come home and because my brother lives out here and my niece and nephew, and now because they're in their 20s, they bring their better halves. So it's kind of grown into, oh, wow, you know, there's going to be 16 of us at the table. So we kind of made a decision. Let's go traditional for Thanksgiving and allow ourselves, like Christmas, to be a little less traditional. And we'll either do our Vietnamese food or, you know, last year we did a prime rib, but we smoked the prime rib and that was really good too. Mm. One of the things that I do with my turkey is I don't roast my whole turkey anymore. I do the spatchcock method. And I know that I said that, you know, my focus is the rolls.
Yeah.
But I do that, you know, the whole ensemble. If you miss one part, you know, the whole thing crumbles on you.
Well, and the turkey's obviously the center point of any Thanksgiving. So you don't do it traditionally, but it sounds like you get some better flavor out of that. Tell us, you know, what's your advice to home cooks who are all, you know, going to head to the kitchen and try and make this very important meal this year?
You know, one of the things that people really miss is the timing. Mm-hmm. If you're going to do a turkey, make sure you make room in your fridge the night before or two nights before, actually. Take your turkey out of the packaging, get yourself a rack where you can put that turkey on and let it air dry. 9 out of 10 times, if your skin's not crispy, it's because you either brined your turkey and didn't give it enough time to dry the skin. And that's just going to level up your game. The other thing that I do, and this is something that my dad did growing up, I take a gin and I actually, you know, put some little garlic salt in there. A little chicken bouillon, to believe it or not. And I inject the turkey breast with it as much as I can. And, you know, when you cook it, the alcohol evaporates and you're just left with the botanical flavors of the juniper and, you know, the little salt from the bouillon. And it gives just a well-rounded flavor and it keeps the breast moist. And it really comes out phenomenal.
Oh, that sounds really good. Yeah. I want to ask you one final quick question before I let you go, because I think part of Thanksgiving is the meal and the cooking and the timing and all these kind of methods you're describing. But part of it's like the traditions, the nostalgia, the sort of ambiance. What do you make of that? Like, what are your favorite parts of just sitting at that table with the family and, you know, participating in this big holiday every year?
Well, you know, it's I think for us, you know, building our own traditions. I obviously, you know, I came to the United States when I was young and, you know, we never really built the Thanksgiving traditions that we have now. And so when you sit around the table and you're breaking bread with family and friends, and you're really, you know, just sitting there and you're catching up with your whole family. You're hearing about, you know, what Nick is doing, what Maddie's doing in school. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, it's just we're making great memories with our family and eating some good food. And every year we look forward to it, and it just keeps growing and growing. Eventually, you know, I wouldn't mind having grandkids. Down the road, I could just see generations of Robsons.
Well, best of luck on that. I hope that comes to fruition for you. That is Chef Doug Robson, chef and founder of Gallo Blanco Cafe, Otro Cafe, and Tasota. Doug, thank you so much for coming back on the show. I really appreciate it, and happy Thanksgiving.
You as well. Thanks for having me.
Well, if that conversation with Chef Robson has you feeling ambitious, he sent us the recipe for his buttery croissant-y rolls. We're going to post it on our website, theshow.kjzz.org.
And that'll do it for this Wednesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being along. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman.